Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it's so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite.
Is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and so I would reprimand you over that.
Okay, hello, 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 and welcome to Ivorcy Trouble with Wallace and what?
Thompson.
Where's she gone?
So, who would have ever thought that there'd be a day... And I foresee trouble with Daly and Wallace without Daly.
I've officially usurped Claire.
Yeah,
and I've dyed my hair red.
I couldn't listen to her anymore. She's in Bulgaria, and God knows what she's at there. It is political work.
Not and fun and games and anyway. Yeah.
And I can assure you there's no fun and games there.
Yeah.
I think she's going to need some mental treatment when she comes out of the place.
Yeah, we've talked a bit about Bulgaria before in the podcast about all of Claire's work on rule of law issues.
Were you talking to her yesterday or today?
No, I'm sure.
She's getting grief.
But anyway, when she's back...
Anyway, listen, she probably deserves it.
She'll give us a report back, I'm sure. There's a lot to tell us.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's quite known in the European Parliament for being hard on Bulgaria. The Eastern Europeans shrivel when they see her walk down the corridors.
Well, anyway, look, she might even have a different story when she comes back. But anyway, we'll wait for... Let's for her to talk about.
Yeah, we'll let you hear say that. Anyway, so today we're not going to go on our choo-choo train across the European Union because we'll wait till Claire's back. But we're going to talk about the European climate law, which is a really important piece of legislation, one of the hallmarks of this whole commission. It's going to be voted tomorrow it's going to be voted today by the time this podcast comes out in the European Parliament. Really important vote. And then we'll talk a bit about pollinators, bees. Bees are a big topic here in the European Union as well. Lots of non-action happening there. And then there's something to say on rail, particularly in Wexford. So we'll get to that as well. But first on the climate law. It's basically a proposal that was promised in the Green Deal. It's a governance framework to look at mitigation and adaptation across the European Union and have some sort of structure about how we reach climate neutrality by 2050. It's already, so procedurally, the Parliament had amended the proposal, the Council did the same, and they've gone, we voted on the position, Parliament adopted a position, they went to negotiations, and now we have a final agreement. So this is what we call the provisional agreement from trilogues, the negotiations between the Parliament and the Council. And we have to vote on that before it becomes law. That's the final piece of text. And we go yay or nay. And if it gets enough yays, it becomes law. And it'll enter into force in a few years. Mick, you're going to vote against this. And Claire, you did 87 amendments, a huge amount of amendments to this in the committee stage. Tell us why you're not happy with this final result. What came out of it? So,
yeah, well, listen, as you were explaining, Damien, while the Parliament asked for a 60% reduction, and we even were looking for more at that time, to actually meet the Paris Agreement, they reckoned that we needed something in the range of 67. But the Parliament voted on 60 anyway, but we're not even getting that. Because as we've discussed before, when the Parliament makes a decision, it then goes into trilogue with the Parliament, Council and Commission. And the end result is a pathetic 55%, and it's not even a full 55%. It's 55% net. So there's actually balances being put into it where allowances are being made for carbon sinks and that kind of thing. So the 55% net is not an absolute reduction. It's really, in absolute terms, it's really only about 52. Mm. And given that... we probably would have needed something like 67 to be compliant with the Paris Agreement. You wonder what is wrong and why are we taking such a weak position?
Yeah, and it's sad. The 67% is what the UNEP, the UN environmental program body said is the amount that the whole globe needs to decarbonize by 2030. And obviously the European Union is a very rich part of the globe and it has caused a huge amount of emissions. So there's a whole historical responsibility there that's not even taken into account for the 67 or 68% target, which the UN is saying we need to do by 2030. Then the EU comes out with saying, okay, here's a 55 net target. So not only have they completely undershot the whole global reductions by 2030, but they've introduced this new concept, a net target for 2030, which, if you're confused by it, it makes perfect sense because it seems like it's designed to confuse people because it's very hard to explain. It's about mixing sinks with emissions reductions. It's like talking about climate neutrality, but without the actual neutrality. It's before the neutrality stage. So if you're confused, that's probably the whole goal of setting the net target. And it's a big game changer because under the Paris Agreement, all the parties to the Paris Agreement have to submit their own NDCs, the National Determined Contributions, which are how much they're going to decarbonize by a certain time. And to date, they've just been standard emissions reduction targets. We reduce our emissions by this percent compared to that year. That's it. And now the EU has completely gone rogue and changed the whole game, changed the whole rules of the game and said, look, now we're submitting a net target. So yeah. they're confusing things. And like Mick was saying, it makes it sound like the target is much higher. When you do the maths, when you look behind the accounting tricks, it's actually lower than what it says. So it's really a tactic to obscure the whole thing and make the thing very confusing and make it look like we're doing some work.
When yeah. So. And the real sad part about it is that if we're going to meet these targets worldwide, we're really dependent on the richer countries to take more responsibility. They are the ones who've caused most of the damage so far. They've even caused most of the damage in the Global South. But Global South countries are not in the same position to make the adjustments in their countries because they've been kept so poor by the likes of the developed North, by the likes of the Europeans and others. And so in actual fact, we are throwing them under the bus. And it's really, really bad form on the EU's part. We talk and talk and talk, but we just don't put it into action.
Yeah.
We don't deliver, and that's very sad.
Exactly. I think the whole thing of voting against this, it's not to vote against the whole climate law as a thing, because it's actually good to have such a governance structure, a whole climate law, but it's to send them back to the negotiating table. So if this were rejected now in the parliament, it would mean that they'd have to renegotiate in the trilogues. So I think a clear red line would be we don't want a net target, and it needs to be at least, the very least, this target that the UN is saying we have to decarbonize by 2030, because anything less than that is actually just robbery of the Global South. It's a commitment to climate catastrophe and it's throwing 1.5 out the window. So it's just very difficult to look at this climate law agreement we've been presented with and give it a rubber stamp, because it's just pathetic. So
yeah, I mean, it's really sad that despite the fact that most people are copping onto the fact that we have incredible challenges to save the planet, and yet the richer countries think that they can kick the can down the road forever. But that's really what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Moreover, just on that as well, there's been there's no member state targets. There's no member state obligation to meet climate neutrality. There's no binding 2040 target. There's nothing on fossil fuels. So the Parliament's position was actually all right when we voted on it a while ago. And you and Claire voted in favour of it. But like, to just really get, it just shows you, we've talked about it before, that when the Parliament goes into negotiations with the Council, it gets absolutely thrashed around the place, because it always has to settle for something very, very
yeah,
poor.
Yeah, and what you have in the Council, as we've said before, is like, for example, you had, if they were discussing something on environment, you'd have the environment ministers from the 27 member states getting together, and they bring all the fears and lobbying with them, and they go up against the Parliament position. Very often the Commission ends up being kind of trying to compromise between them a lot of the time, but invariably the Council tends to be by far the most conservative, by far the least progressive, and it's criminal that unfortunately, too often, the citizens of these individual member states don't actually realise what is being done in their name.
Yeah, very sad. Speaking of more sad stuff, pollinators, the bees.
Yeah,
they have a hard time, don't they, Mick?
There was in 2013. There was a big guidance document drawn up, right? And at that time, they said that that in a worst case scenario, that the most in terms of an acceptable level of colony reduction in bees caused by pesticides should not go above it should not go above 7%. So 7%, they said, was the threshold, that we can't go past that. And people should realise that 3/4 of EU food production is dependent on pollinators. 3/4, 75% of European food production is dependent on pollinators, and we're destroying them. I mean, what is wrong with us? We actually wrote to Charlie McConnellogue because he's the Minister for Agriculture, and he's coming to Brussels on Monday, and there's going to be a meeting about this, but it's behind closed doors. There's no transparency. We're just going to get a result at the end of the day. They're going to go in and trash it out. And to be honest with you now, we'll see what happens, but we'd be very scared that they're going to have a figure far too much higher than 7%. They shouldn't go one bit above it. There's a huge diversity between the countries and what the different countries are in favour of. And just to give you an idea, in this case, I mean, we give out about countries being good on this and bad on that, but in this case, France, the Netherlands and Sweden all favour 7%. But there's a reckless group of member states that include Belgium, Hungary, Greece and Spain, who are prepared to tolerate 23%. So imagine, these countries produce a lot of food, right? And they're prepared to go to 23% because they're under pressure from big agri. They want to continue using pesticides that kill pollinators. You couldn't make it up. So this meeting is going to be had on Monday. We've written and we sent an email to Charlie today to just highlight the fact how important it is that Ireland should take a position of 7%. Mm-hmm. Now, because it's in secret, behind closed doors. Now, listen, when you're elected by the people, surely every decision you made should be made public because you're answerable to the people. But if you go into a closed room and it's in secrecy, then they're not answerable. Mm. We're just going to get a 27 member state agreed position. God knows what it is. Yeah. But each individual country won't know what their agriculture minister did in there. Yeah. And that is shocking.
Yeah. And the parliament is by far the most transparent institution in the European Union, which is probably ironic, the amount that you still don't know about what happens in the parliament, you know. But you can look up amendments, you can look up votes, you can do things like this. But in the commission, where the member states are also represented on these standing committees, and in the council, it's an absolute black box. So unless there's a clear commitment from the Minister for Agriculture about Ireland's stance and an absolute commitment to no more than 7%. Like, we're talking about how many bees do we want to die in a biodiversity and climate crisis. And it just shows you, like we were saying, about the power of lobbies at national level to decide national positions, which are very strongly represented then by the member states here and the council and commission.
There's a general agreement that without information, there's no democracy. Without transparency, there's no democracy. Without accountability, there is no democracy. Mm. And Charlie McConnellogue should say on Monday morning, before he goes to Brussels, he should tell the Irish people what his position is going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
And stick to
and
it.
And be proud of it.
Yeah. Let's just tell us the truth, whatever it is. Right?
But people love bees as well. Talk to anyone in Ireland and they're mad about bees, and they know that they're under a huge amount of pressure and that they're dying. There's the absolute collapse of bee populations and even species. We're losing species and people feel very passionate about it.
Oh, God.
Emails and
contact. My father had 15 hives and the bees wouldn't sting him. His arms would be covered in bees sometimes, right? And none of them would sting him. He loved the bees and the bees loved him.
Yeah.
It was great.
And you barely even see them anymore, though, the wild bees, you know. So people see also this decline Yeah,
and
them, you know?
Two of my sisters, Maids and Monica, are both very interested in bees. Maids actually starts in Italy, who lives in Italy, right? Yeah. She actually started producing queens.
Yeah?
Yeah, she was breeding queen bees.
Doing something to help them.
Yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, the Parliament has been very strong on this as well, because there's obviously been a lot of pressure and publicly, and the Parliament has given a lot of support for higher protection for bees and restoration targets, and to revise the whole initiative as well on protecting pollinators. So it's really up to member states to step up and people to pressure their governments to publicly commit to higher protection and really to stop this whole agri lobby from deciding on biodiversity protection, because it can't work that way.
Yeah, and of course, what it ends up at next Monday is that instead of an environmental decision that's really going to be made, it'll be a political one. Yeah. And it should be environmental.
Or, yeah, the whole thing of science-based policy, you'd have a laugh about that now in the European Union, because it's just not considered at all. The science is, it's all politically decided science. So if we're told this is the amount of bee decline that's acceptable or sustainable, it doesn't matter, because it's about how much the agri-lobby wants and how much the member states agree on. So the same with the climate law, like we said, we know the percentage of how much we need to decarbonize by, but it doesn't matter because member states want an easier target. So it's very depressing. So anyway, we'll keep you up to date on the pollinators, though, because a lot is happening here in the Parliament on that. But on rail stuff in Wexford, tell me about what's happening there.
Yeah, there's it's really interesting, and there's a group. After setting up in Wexford, it's called Southeast on Track, and they're really impressive, they are. And what's behind it is, well, first of all, look, there's a train from Dublin to Rosslare that goes through Wexford Town, right? Wexford Town is, you know, it's only about 10, 15 minutes from Rosslare, and Rosslare is the end of the line, right? But there used to be a train then from Rosslare that went right across Wexford and into Waterford. And from Waterford, it was able to go to Cork, it was able to go to Limerick, right? So it was a network for the whole South East, right? Now, okay, what happened then was in 2010, after the banking crisis in 2008, there was huge austerity in Ireland. We borrowed billions and billions to give back to our useless, failed banks that should have been allowed rot. But in order to get the money back, we cut public services and we made the people pay. But anyways, the line was closed in 2010. And now, given the environmental challenges, there's a move to reopen the line. Now, the reason why it's become very important at the moment is because there's a threat of, they were threatened to take the tracks up. Now, and I'll tell you why. There's greenways going in different parts of Ireland. And in some parts, they were looking at putting them where the rail tracks had been, where the rails weren't being used anymore. Now, it would be fine to use, greenways are a great idea, but they should not be replacing rail. And just to give you an idea, up to now, Ireland has been maintaining the lines so that they're still usable in case we ever use them again. But if we stop maintaining them, they will deteriorate. And if we take them up, just to give you a look at the money side of it, right now, one of the reasons why it's actually attractive to bring them back, obviously we have the environmental issue. We have the fact that we have to, our public transport in Ireland is probably the worst of the 27 member states. I'd say without any shadow of a doubt, it's the worst in Europe. We love building roads and we love buying cars, but we don't like investing in public transport. And that needs to change because of the environmental challenges and because of the targets that we have to meet. And we'll be paying fines if we don't meet our targets. And one of the ways of meeting them is to get people out of their cars and get them into public transport, especially rail. And also, we need to get freight lorries off the road and get freight on rail. And another big aspect of this is that Ross Airport is already expanding dramatically in use because of Brexit, because now it's become less attractive for Ireland to go across England to get to the European mainland. And there's far more trade already going direct from Rosslare to France. Okay, so Rosslare is going to be used a lot more. So that means an awful lot of extra freight. And that should, a lot of that, if possible at all, should go on rail rather than putting more trucks on already heavily used roads, right? Yeah. So that's one of the aspects of it. Now, on the money side of it, as I was about to say, if they maintain it and if they wanted to bring in a rail for passengers that was much faster and it can be done, they can get a train that will do 110 kilometres an hour on average, right? And the cost of bringing that Rosslare, Wexford, Rosslare, Waterford line up to scratch, improving it to a point where it will take a much faster train and take more trains, because when it was closed down, one of the reasons it closed down was the service was no good. There was only one train a day. It was rubbish. People couldn't use it, right? Mm. So the service has to be made good. There has to be several trains in both directions each day. The trains have to be quicker. To make them quicker would cost between 30 and 60 million for the whole thing, right? Mm. For an upgrade. But if you take up the tracks and decide in a few years' time, you know what? We should have rail in Ireland. Do you know what it costs to put the same back in? 650 million. 650 million, as opposed to if they maintain it, keep it there, the upgrade would cost between 30 and 60. Mm. Now, that's a no-brainer. But yet, at the same time, they've been threatening to take them up of late. I mean, that is criminal, right? So this group have come together and they're looking at fighting to keep it in place. And one of the aspects of it as well, there's the biggest bridge on the line is over the River Barrow, right, near Ross. And there's talks, and that goes up and down to facilitate boats going into Ross Port, right? And that obviously costs money as well, maintaining it and keeping it right. But there's actually a threat that they're talking about fixing it upright. And if they do, it won't be any use again for rail.
Hmm.
So there's an emergency about it now to stop the Barrow Bridge being pinned up permanently, because it will really kill. It'll make it actually a lot more expensive. If that bridge had to go in again, and it's a huge bridge, right? Hmm. It's very long. And if that had to be redone completely, it would be madness. It would be cost a fortune, right? Whereas maintaining it isn't costing an arm and a leg. So there's a big move to protect that.
And this is surprising when you think of our Minister for Transport is none other than Eamon Ryan. So we're all for greenways. They're lovely and they should be promoted, but they're obviously in a sensible way. And you're not going to replacing rail lines with greenways isn't very clever when we need to significantly boost rail. So what's behind that?
And he is the Minister for Transport. So the Green Party leader is the Minister for Transport, and the pressure is on him. And he may deliver. I'm not judging him yet on it, right? We'll wait and see. And I actually think that on this occasion, I think he might get it right.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll probably have a challenge with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael about this, but look, we're hopeful anyway that he does get it right. And just some people seem to think that, replacing diesel and petrol cars is the answer to all our problems in terms of transport. That's not true. We need to get the cars off the road. And this idea that electric cars are going to fix everything, that is absolute nonsense. And just to give you an idea, right, apart from the fact that lithium mining, which is the mining, lithium is what's needed for the batteries to drive the electric cars, right? And the lithium mining for the batteries for electric cars is already generating an ecological crisis in South America, in the Andes Mountains, right? And they're burning through water tables, draining lakes, destroying ecosystems, and driving indigenous farmers off their land. Right, and in order to transition the global fleet of 2 billion vehicles to electric, it's going to require extracting another 24 million tons of lithium, and the ecological consequences of that are unimaginable. It actually is there by sea. It's mostly in Bolivia and Ecuador, and it's probably in Peru as well. But So we don't just need more electric cars. And of course, we do need more electric cars, right? But we have to reduce car use. And we have to create frequent, affordable and far-reaching public transport systems. And rail is the cleanest and the best of them all.
Yeah, it's without a shadow of a doubt that rail needs to be absolutely promoted. I know Claire's not here today. We're talking about transport. She'd love to be talking about transport, so we'll have to come back to it a lot. But yeah. The EU has committed to 90% emissions reductions by 2050 for transport, which is a big reduction. It still should be more than that, but whatever, 90 is big. There's no way that can be done with the same level of private car ownership we have now. And like you said, it's actually, we have a strategy now on sustainable and smart mobility in the EU. It does talk about promoting public transport, but it doesn't actually talk about reducing the amount of private car ownership as well, which, like you said, the critical raw materials involved, the raw resources, is just not possible. And to get all these cars off the market, create new cars, put them on the market, it's mad. And it's actually, you'll hear about electric vehicles a lot, and it's because it's what the car industry also really wants you to know. They want you to know we're being sustainable, we're on a path to climate neutrality ourselves, you'll have electric vehicles by a certain date, yada, yada, yada. What they don't want to hear is that we need public investment in public infrastructure for transport. We need to shift to trains. We need to shift to rail. You won't hear that. Obviously, we have massive problems with aviation and maritime, decarbonizing those into those sectors, and they need different types of fuels that can't be electrified as easily as rail. But rail is a no-brainer. It can be electrified. It can actually be, it's the biggest key to decarbonizing transport. And as you pointed to, Mick, on freight, it's a huge issue. Just moving freight onto rail and inland waterways would make a huge difference. Also, yeah, in air pollution, people hate getting stuck behind a lorry on the motorway or whatever. It's just would take a load of really polluting vehicles off the roads. It would clean up the place a lot, and we'd have things better, you know, and quicker. And we have Euro standards and emission standards and things like this, but we need to do a big transformative shift, really.
And at the moment, right, the figures show that the growth in emissions from SUVs are cancelling out the gains from electric cars, right? Isn't that a shocking thing that's happening in 2021? And listen, another problem as well is that an awful lot of the electricity that's used to drive these cars is not clean. About 80%, for example, in Ireland, 80% of electricity still comes from burning gas or coal or peat or using oil. Now, I mean, we don't even have clean electricity. People pretending that electric cars are going to fix our problems are just being deceitful.
Yeah, so exactly. It's the whole policy of energy needs to transform with it as well and adapt the grid to cope with it as well. But anyway, I think that's a bit mad, to be honest, the whole greenway on a railway. That's actually, what's really hard about the shift to rail is actually finding these paths and all the legal problems as well of just getting a line, do you know? So well, when there's one place already.
I mean, that's why the rail line seems so attractive to them, right? But what they could do is stay real close to a rail line, but leave the rail line there and put a greenway close to it where it's feasible. But remember that put it in a way that trains will be running on those tracks again.
Yeah. What have you seen in Europe and the places you've been about the rail systems? We know in Ireland, we barely have a rail system.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, look, it's the central station in Turin, for example, and Italy is not the best country in Europe, but it's very good. But France would bury it. France is amazing for trains, right? You can go from Paris to Lyon in an hour and three quarters, right? It takes about 5 hours to drive it. You can go from, when I'm going to Strasbourg, I often go down on the train. Mm. It's an hour and 20 minutes from Brussels to Paris. Magnificent.
It's the same from where I live.
About three and a half hours in the car. An hour and 20 minutes on the train. In Italy, right, Turin is 160 kilometres. Central station Turin is 160 kilometres from the central station in Milan. 45 minutes on a train. Price? You can go on that train. If you book in advance, you can buy that ticket for 16 euro. If you only buy it on the day, it's going to cost you about 35. But they have a slow train. Mm. It's an hour and 50 minutes and it costs €12.50.
Yeah.
Right? Now try and get from Cork to Dublin on a train for €12.50. But you see, one of the reasons our trains are expensive in Ireland is we're not doing it right. It's not a good operation. There's not enough trains. They're not quick enough. And we just haven't put the work into it.
Yeah.
And we just said, it doesn't work. And years ago, right, I remember arguing in the Dáil, when I went to the Dáil, listen, we've got to do more rail. And they said, sorry now, it's not feasible. And one of the reasons that it wasn't economically viable. And before a state can invest in rail like that, right, the private sector have to be able to compete with them and have to be interested. It's part of the state aid rules, which are not, there's an awful lot of bad aspects to them, right? Yeah. So it depends then. So is rail financially viable for a government to put in place? Well, what decides that is how quickly do you have to get your return? If you spend X amount of billions putting it in place, how many years are you allowed to wait before it's actually paid for itself? Now, and if you set that figure at 15 years, and that's for, I'm not sure what the figures were exactly, but it was real low, right? If you set it at 15 years, well, yeah, no, you won't get your money back in 15 years. So then it was considered not financially viable. Yeah. But if you set it for 30 years, right, and said, right, okay, this is a 30-year project. We're going to spend this much now, and we want it to pay for itself within 30 years, not 15. Mm. Then it becomes financially viable. Then it's also of interest to the private sector, right? And then the state sector can do it without as much hassle, right? So, I mean, this is how we have to start thinking about these things. We have to think long term. And one of the things in politics that stops people and politicians from acting in the long term is because they only get elected every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they think 4 or 5 years ahead and they're not worried about 20 or 30 years ahead.
How far ahead do you think?
I mean, but seriously, though, I mean, that's a big problem.
Yeah, yeah.
People get into the government and they say, right, we're going to face an election in 4.5, 5 years' time.
Yeah.
Where do we want to be? Because that's what we have to look at. Because we want to get re-elected.
Yeah.
So planning for 10 years is even too much for them. Planning for 30 is off the Richter scale for them. Because we're not planning for our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just logic, like.
Yeah. I mean, Belgium has a great rail system. I think it's quite cheap. You can get a ticket of 10 rides and you just write in where you're going. It's €7 each way, so you can go anywhere in the country for €7.
Amazing,
people take their bikes on trains all the time. There's huge bike, what they're called, feet stations.
People
leave their bikes at all the stations. They bring them on, they cycle around Ghent, they come back to Brussels, cycle around Brussels, whatever. And people live in completely different cities to where they work. And they go to another part of the same in the Netherlands as well. So it's kind of a model of how amazing rail can be for everyone's lives. And people don't own cars then. They don't want them because why would you want one when the train is quicker and you can take your bike even? But the shift of taking the fact that over 70% of emissions from transport are from road transport, it just shows it, like, it can't be sustained at the level it is. And in Ireland, you see huge investments still going into roads and it's not being moved around. So
now, could you imagine,
will it happen? Will that switch happen? I don't know.
In Brussels.
In Ireland, yeah.
In Brussels, now the traffic can be heavy enough at times, right?
Yeah.
But this is a very busy city, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people in it. But could you imagine what it'd be like if they didn't have the metro system and the tram system?
The most extensive tram system, when you think of it. I think we have two lines that don't connect. And in Brussels, there's trams
everywhere.
They're
all over the place. And even the trams and the metros link together.
Yeah.
Right. And they have a bus system as well that will make a show of ours.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not rocket science, you know.
No. Anyway, that's it from today. That's a bit of climate law, a bit on bees, a bit on our passion for rail. Anyway, you can see. And as you said, we'll get back on the train for the Euro trip. I'll go to Slovakia next week with our country of the week when Claire is back. But that's it from today. Get in touch, share the podcast, tell us what you want us to talk about, get your questions over. Any last words there, Mick?
Good luck to Italia on Saturday.
And good luck to Portugal tonight. Let's see how they do.
Italy are playing Austria on Saturday.
Yeah.
I was in Rome for the Welsh game and I had been there for the Turkey game before that. I won't make it this weekend to London, even though I had tickets. And but as I have to, believe it or not, very bad planning on my part. Mm. We'll tell you about it next week. But I'm actually going to be in Syria. On some political work, which will be very interesting. And we can have a real good chat about that next week. But in the meantime, I'm looking forward to the Italians stuffing the Austrians who flew a Israeli flag over government buildings in Vienna when Israel were massacring women and children in Gaza, in Palestine. Sick. So good luck to the Italians on that one.
Yeah, I'd say they'll beat them now.
Well, listen, Italy are the team of the tournament at the moment.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean it doesn't mean they're going to win it. Most people would probably still say that the French look the strongest, but Italy is playing the best, and Italy have a real breath of fresh air about them. They are beautiful to watch. Sitting in the stadium last Sunday night, watching them, they only beat Wales 1-0, but the play, he made 8 changes from the starting lineup from the previous game against Switzerland when they beat the Swiss 3-0. He made 8 changes and he brought on 5 subs, and 3 of them had never played before, right? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant squad, loads of young fellas in it, a lovely attitude, playing lovely football. Mm. Fucking beautiful.
A beautiful game. Anyway, let's see how it goes.
Bye-bye.